Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be talking to reporter Michelle Chen about shameful abortion regulations affecting daily operations in clinics. Lena Dunham makes a political ad and conservatives freak out because sex. Also, things aren't looking good for Planned Parenthood in Texas. Tina Fey spoke at the Center for Reproductive Rights 20th Anniversary Gala, and a short clip of her speech went viral online, and for good reason. It's hilarious.
And if I have to listen to one more gray-faced man with a $2 haircut explain to me what rape is, I'm gonna lose my mind. I watch these guys and I'm like, what is happening? Am I a secretary on Mad Men?
She also went on to suggest that if they keep passing restrictions on reproductive health, before you know it, pap smears will be replaced with some redneck sniffing your saddle seat. So, Lena Dunham did an ad encouraging young women to vote by comparing your first time voting to your first time having sex. It's a very light, silly ad that endorses Obama and works as a joke that many politicians and pundits on both sides of the aisle have used before to get people to vote. But this is the first time that I know of that a young single woman with a large audience made that joke.
Time shouldn't be with just anybody. You want to do it with a great guy. It should be with a guy with beautiful... someone who really cares about and understands women. A guy who cares whether you get health insurance, and specifically whether you get birth control. The consequences are huge. You want to do it with a guy who brought the troops out of Iraq. You don't want a guy who says, oh, hey, I'm at the library studying, when really he's out not signing the Lilly Ledbetter Act. Or who thinks that gay people should never have beautiful, complicated weddings of the kind we see on Bravo or TLC all the time.
I watched the ad and thought it was fine and not particularly surprising. If you want to sell something to college kids, using sex is a smart way to do it. But of course, according to conservatives these days, if a woman expresses any interest, nay, even knowledge, of this sex thing, she must be a completely out-of-control slut who has no time for studying, eating, or possibly breathing because she spends all her time having sex and sucking down contraception. So naturally, that belief shaped the hysterical right-wing reaction to this ad. And if you think I'm exaggerating how conservatives think of women who are young, single, and not afraid to acknowledge the existence of sex, I'm pretty much directly quoting Rush Limbaugh.
Insulting to women. It again looks at women as monolithic sex machines who want to make sure they've got unending birth control pills and then free trip to Planned Parenthood the next day, all paid for by Obama.
See what I mean? If you value your reproductive rights or what insurance you earn to pay for your actual healthcare needs, that means you're a sex machine. I don't get why Limbaugh is complaining about seeing women as monolithic, since he himself has, here and elsewhere, routinely claimed that women who use contraception are sluts or sex machines. He's basically saying that 99% of women who have ever had sex even just once that use contraception are sluts and sex machines. That's pretty monolithic. During this rant, he also took what I'd consider a really sad, dim view of marriage as a burden women should be forced to suffer instead of something women should want to undertake out of love.
This is something that was a campaign ad that was aimed at securing women who want to turn their lives over to government. Single women, perpetually single women, who still want to have a kid. But they don't want to be burdened with some lousy husband in the process. And government will take care of that. Government will make sure that you get the kid, and government will give you benefits so that you can raise the kid. And you don't need to find some lout to marry or live with.
I'm not entirely sure that Limbaugh's belief that women should be frog-marched into marriage with, his words, lousy husbands is really convincing. For all the railing against socialism, Limbaugh seems to view women as a resource that should be distributed on socialist principles, with every man, no matter how much of a lousy husband, having a right to a wife of his own to pick up after him and tend to him sexually. His utter rage at a society that has decided that women shouldn't have to be stuck in bad marriages does make sense if you consider that he's been divorced 3 times already. Limbaugh was far from the only conservative who got bent out of shape over Lena Dunham making a sex joke. Indeed, it would be easier to count the conservatives who didn't get bent out of shape at it, for exactly the reasons Limbaugh spells out. They're furious that young, single women are in no hurry to get married to any old dude who will have them. Lawrence O'Donnell did a segment making fun of the reaction.
Reagan got 100% of the votes from the can't take a joke crowd and 110% of the votes from the can't take a dirty joke crowd. But that crowd has forgotten a lot about Reagan, like how many times he raised taxes as governor and president, and today's uncomfortable fact that when he was running for president, Ronald Reagan actually told a double entendre joke that ingeniously included within its overall double entendre structure an internal double entendre that allows for both straight and gay entendre.
Listen, I know what it's like the first time you pull that Republican lever because I used to be a Democrat myself. And I can tell you, it only hurts for a minute. And then you'll feel just great.
But as Limbaugh made clear, they don't mind dirty jokes coming from men. It's women whose humor they object to because it reminds them that women don't have to be submissive fake virgins who are married off young to lousy husbands they can't escape anymore. And that really is why they're objecting to all of this. I'd like to welcome Michelle Chen to the program. Michelle recently wrote a long-form investigative piece for Salon in partnership with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute about the impact that the exponentially increasing abortion restrictions on the state level are having on women's quality of health care. She's here to talk about her findings. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
So your article, which was about, you know, all of the various abortion restrictions that are out there, from forced ultrasounds to forcing doctors to read scripts to patients seeking abortions, basically feels like that what it feels like is these restrictions are forcing doctors and nurses to shame patients against their will. Can you talk about how these regulations kind of play out daily and in the doctor's office?
Yeah, I see it as sort of a kind of low-grade psychological warfare against abortion providers and their patients. The research actually shows that a lot of these laws don't have a really discernible impact in terms of deterring abortion itself sort of on the aggregate level. So what happens is it just makes the process of obtaining an abortion a lot more onerous for medical providers and their staff, and a lot more potentially traumatic and at least, you know, inconvenient for a lot of women. It sometimes adds costs, perhaps hundreds of dollars for extra procedures. Women might have to travel more because way the rules are structured, it makes them make more than one appointment to get, you know, a procedure that should take maybe, you know, within a day. So what happens is it just makes the whole process a lot more burdensome for people. And of course, that will disproportionately affect women with fewer resources. So a lot of times these laws fall heaviest on poor women, women of color, rural women who don't have access to an abortion clinic in their area. And basically, I wanted to sort of get inside of clinics and just see what kind of impact it has on the day-to-day practice of providers and the sort of experience of women, because given that we know that statistically it's not really an effective abortion deterrent, you can only imagine that the impact is just to be to make women feel a lot worse about doing what they're doing, and it's going to make doctors feel more apprehensive about doing their jobs and being responsible medical professionals.
Do you feel like anyone passing these laws really thinks they're actually going to reduce the number of abortions, or does it really feel strongly after doing this clinic research that the intention and result is just shaming?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I don't, you know, I'm not going to, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I know that many of the most anti-abortion legislators are really carefully scrutinizing these laws of the research around them. I'm pretty sure that they're getting fed like talking points and legislation template from various anti-choice groups out there. I think they have a symbolic value for conservatives who are trying to play to a really hardcore right-wing base. You know, a lot of the language of these pieces of legislation, which have proliferated over the years, I mean, you know, hundreds of bills have been introduced just in recent months. According to the Guttmacher Institute, you know, all these bills, they really follow, you know, similar templates that have basically been scripted by anti-choice groups. So I don't know that politicians are really thinking that deeply about it. I think their main motivation might be just to demonstrate sort of their anti-abortion bona fides to their constituencies. And they probably don't care all that much about the actual impact of these laws. I mean, frankly, you know, on some level, I think that even the anti-choice folks know that, you know, women are going to be, you know, going through hell and high water to get abortions no matter what. The best they can do is to make people feel, you know, much, much worse about what they're doing. And so I think, yeah, the shame factor is a factor. And I also think that for medical providers, what they're trying to do is intimidate them, basically, make them feel like anything they do on the job could be a liability. In many cases, what I found when I was interviewing medical personnel who are involved in this process, you know, they find some pretty ingenious ways to navigate these laws that allow them to remain, you know, ethical professionals. And not compromise, you know, their basic sense of medical ethics in order to comply with the law. And sometimes it's really difficult when the law is basically instructing you to give these women misleading or, you know, potentially inaccurate information. I mean, there are statutes on the books that, you know, that pressure physicians to talk about a link between breast cancer and abortion when the research does not actually indicate that there is any real, you know, causal link there. So, you know, it's a really difficult position for the physician to be in because, you know, they're in a lot of power in terms of their position as medical providers, and yet their practice is sort of being interfered with by the state, and it really has no basis in science. So the impact on abortion providers can only be to, you know, make their jobs more difficult, make it costlier for them to practice abortions, and possibly in the long run to deter people from, like, entering the practice itself.
I thought it was sort of interesting that there was a lot of concern from the providers you interviewed about the scripts that they have to read and the bad information that they have to provide the patients and the waiting periods and all these other sort of shaming and scare tactics, that the patients themselves were thinking that this was coming from the providers themselves. How did doctors navigate this problem? How did they try to sort of get around, you know, the fear that the patients have that this sort of negativity is coming from the providers themselves?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because I think first and foremost, the providers, they are concerned with, you know, giving their patients the best care possible. And it's really difficult when they're sort of between a rock and a hard place between what the state, you know, tells them to do. And, you know, mind you, these lawmakers are not doctors and have very little idea of what an abortion is actually about. And you have these women who in many cases are already really burdened by what else is going on in their lives, and they might be traumatized when they're sitting there in their office. And meanwhile, they're getting this counseling or they're getting this, you know, forced ultrasound. They don't really understand what's happening to them. So I think in a lot of ways the provider has it worse because they know, they understand what's going on multiple levels, and they need to at the same time sort of, you know, interact with the patient in a way that makes her feel safe and that ensures her trust, right? So some providers I know, you know, the way the laws are written, they don't actually prescript exactly what the physician has to say. They basically just mandate that certain information be provided. So if, for instance, a provider was supposed to give information that links breast cancer and abortion, they would then add sort of their own caveat in there when they're counseling the patient, you know, either the physician or the counselor in the room with the patient would say, you know, we're mandated to do this by law, but, you know, we don't actually endorse this statement, basically. Or, you know, just to let you know, it's not me who's telling you this. This is the state that's telling you this. Frankly, I don't know if that really assuages many women who undoubtedly are probably, you know, pretty confused about what's going on. On the other hand, I think a lot of women, like, they go in for the procedure and a lot of them just kind of suck it up and deal with it. I don't know that, you know, they are that cognizant, I guess, when they're just focused on getting the abortion. You know, I don't know if they're that aware of sort of the politics surrounding it. I think sort of on the macro level, you know, it does raise serious ethical dilemmas. And I think the best that doctors can do, you know, as long as the state is breathing down their necks, is to try to distance themselves from that and hope that patients are sort of at least aware that, you know, there's someone else interfering in the room with them besides, you know, the doctor and the medical staff and them. And so I think that's why it's really important that, you know, women are informed just generally about what's going on with reproductive health and reproductive rights policy, so that when they are experiencing these laws firsthand, they have a sense of where the power imbalance is.
Outside of, like, putting that kind of stress on the doctor-patient relationship and creating this sort of problem of shaming and fear, how are these regulations directly affecting the ability of doctors to provide the actual affordable care?
I spoke with, you know, providers who work with Planned Parenthood, which is, you know, a major institution involved in this work, and even them, who are, you know, a pretty established organization, you know, and you know, pretty on the ball when it comes to complying with all sorts of these regulations on a national level. Even the providers there have a lot of difficulties when trying to work within these constraints. For instance, in Texas, the ultrasound law that came down and was enacted earlier this year, it ended up sort of wreaking havoc on their day-to-day operations because it requires more visits. All ultrasound regulations, when they force them to space them out, they require the ultrasound to be on a different day than the actual abortion procedure, for no particular reason other than to make it more difficult for both the provider and the woman to schedule this. So basically, you know, where you were just trying to manage one appointment before, you now have to manage two appointments for a single abortion. With a doctor and a patient who have different schedules throughout the week. So what this ends up doing is it might, you know, what started out as a 24-hour waiting period now drags into 3, 4, 5 days. You know, some providers note that when a woman is coming up against, say, you know, the clinic's limit, which is 20 weeks, let's say, you know, if her first appointment ends up falling on, you know, 19 weeks and 4 days, and she can't take off work until the next week, then that's going to leave them in a serious situation. The other thing is that, you know, the procedures, both procedures have to be initiated by the same physician, even though an ultrasound does not require, like, a medical doctor to do it. In fact, a lot of times, you know, it's non-doctor personnel who are doing ultrasounds, and they do a better job than the doctors do, because it's not a procedure that necessarily has to be done by a physician. Nonetheless, you know, for a completely unscientific reason, the law is making it so that the same physician has to be involved in both procedures. So, you know, it's these little sort of, you know, irritants that are embedded in the legislation and all the fine print that makes doctors really have to really walk a fine line when it comes down to even simple things like scheduling appointments. Overall, that is going to have a really corrosive impact, not only on their ability to provide abortions efficiently to as many women as possible, but also to the climate in the facility. I found that what some providers say is that, since these laws go into effect, it just really stresses people out. It stresses out the patient. It stresses out the doctors. And it just makes doing the job a whole lot harder. And those are things that are really hard to measure. I mean, I know that statistically there may not be, perhaps a significant deterrent effect of a lot of these laws. But you have to think about overall, year upon year, as these regulations pile up, what is going to be the emotional, the psychological, the social impact of these laws that just treat abortion as if it is something that needs to be deterred at all costs. It really is a simple medical procedure, and yet it is one of the most highly regulated medical procedures, out there, not because of medical concern, but simply out of, political interests.
My guest today has been Michelle Chen. You can find her article titled "It's Not Just Ultrasound, Abortion Rights Under Assault at Salon." It's a good read and highly recommended. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Michelle.
Thanks.
The fight over contraception and other non-abortion-related reproductive health services continues in Texas. As regular readers of Arch Reality Check and regular listeners of this podcast no doubt know, the state of Texas has basically rejected federal funds for women's health care, setting up a state fund that is already underfunded. They claim it's about abortion, but what it's really about is taking away funding from places that actually provide health care, like Planned Parenthood, and redirecting it to places that either don't have the resources to handle the reproductive health care needs of women, or places that don't even want to try, like crisis pregnancy centers. Planned Parenthood got some temporary relief in this battle.
Governor Rick Perry has sought to bar Planned Parenthood's involvement because the group also provides abortions. An appeals court upheld the ban last week, but on Friday, a Texas judge issued a temporary restraining order pending arguments and a new challenge from Planned Parenthood. Attorneys for Planned Parenthood say the ban is illegal because it would force Texas to lose 90% of the program's funding from the federal government.
The Travis County judge offered a temporary injunction on the ban of funding to Planned Parenthood, but things are looking bad for the organization in the state. This lawsuit comes after a really ugly loss in the Fifth Circuit Court, which upheld the ban, which was sadly unsurprising, as that court has a lot of anti-abortion, anti-contraception nutters on it.
Today, for Texas Planned Parenthood clinics, Governor Rick Perry says the state will cut off funding to those clinics right away. He made that announcement after a federal appeals court refused to consider its ruling that Texas can withhold state women's health care funding from Planned Parenthood. Governor Perry released a statement saying, quote, "In Texas, we choose life, and we will immediately begin defunding all abortion affiliates to honor and uphold that choice." Planned Parenthood says that decision will hurt Texas women. It points out that 90% of the money for the program would have come from the federal government and would have helped low-income Texas women get birth control and breast and cervical cancer screenings. Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas released a statement of its own saying, quote, "Politics should never come between a woman and her health care."
It's worth remembering that no matter how many euphemisms for abortion anti-choicers throw up, the reality here is that the funding in question doesn't have anything to do with abortion. This is yet another attack on contraception access, using abortion as a fig leaf, because anti-choicers know that their hostility to contraception isn't politically popular. Indeed, it's worse than just an attack on Planned Parenthood, though since they take on about 40% of the patients in question, that would be bad enough. By flouting federal law, the governor and legislature have an excuse to reject federal funds, which means that most of the fund in question will be hurting for cash. So even if your healthcare provider doesn't provide an abortion at all, you may still have your contraception access cut off for lack of funds. Eventually, it seems they plan to take all women who need assistance to afford contraception and instead direct them to a crisis pregnancy center for a lecture on abstinence and a pat on the head. Rick Perry responded to the lawsuit by releasing a statement that said, in part, quote, "If there was any doubt that Planned Parenthood is more concerned about its own interests than those of Texas women, there is no longer. Having lost its constitutional claims, Planned Parenthood has now turned to Travis County judges in a desperate effort to find some way to keep making money off Texas taxpayers." End quote. This comment is wrong on a number of levels, but the most obvious is that Planned Parenthood, being a nonprofit, doesn't make money. Its government funds go directly into providing services, which is why the first part of that statement makes no sense. Women's interests are served by Planned Parenthood. If they went away, as Perry wants, that would do serious damage to women. They are fighting for women. I hope people aren't letting dishonest rhetoric confuse them on these issues. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts. Nice try, but I'm not going to take your bait edition. Rudy Giuliani was whining about how it's supposedly not fair for women to get contraception because apparently men don't benefit from being able to have sex without causing a pregnancy in his universe.
If you cover condoms, I mean, you got to cover everything, right? If you cover condoms, you should cover Viagra. I mean, it's only fair.
As far as I know, condoms aren't covered. Just prescription medication like birth control pills and IUDs. But what's funny is that Viagra is covered on most health insurance plans, not just with a mandate for no copay like birth control pills. But I refuse to be baited. If no copay Viagra is what you need in order to support common sense preventive health care like contraception, then go for it. I agree. Cover Viagra without a copay. I won't fight you. That's because, unlike those who fight against contraception, I don't fear sex or think half the human race doesn't deserve to have their healthcare needs met if they have sex.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.